dream for me. I've been an awfully good girl, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to a very special episode of the Every Outfit podcast. We are feeling the holiday spirit, and that is why we are doing a very special holiday-themed mailbag episode. You guys came through with your voicemails, with your questions on Instagram.
I wish I had brought some frankincense and myrrh for this occasion. I really fucked up, guys. I think we should start with a question that we received via Instagram. Thoughts on etiquette for fucking your partner in your slash their family home over the holidays?
All right. My answer to this question is actually a follow-up question, which is, how long are you guys gone for?
See, my question is, how thin are the walls? And what is the layout of the house?
I guess anything more than 3 days, yes. But I feel like if you're going for a compressed amount
of time. That's your personal limit?
That's my personal limit. I've revealed too much about myself. But it's like, must you fuck?
Yeah, like maybe like don't fuck. Like your parents and your in-laws should not be hearing you having sex at all. So like go into it thinking like that cannot happen and then make decisions from there. Maybe avoid penetration because that shit is like noisy. Maybe it's oral only for the holidays.
Hand stuff only.
See, I would never like have sex in my parents' house or Tat's parents' house because my parents' house has like the thinnest walls. So that's not happening. And at Tat's parents' house, the guest bedroom is like right next to her parents' bedroom. So also not happening. I couldn't relax under those circumstances.
Yeah, that's where I'm coming from. I guess the answer to our question is the question, must you fuck? We would suggest not, but I guess
if you have to fuck, get a hotel room. It's not that deep. Like, pony up.
Yeah, or I guess wait until they go to bed. But like, that's always dicey. Do you have a father-in-law who's a sleepwalker?
Do you require a Hitachi magic wand? That could cause the lights to go out in the entire house, including the Christmas tree.
That's what I was going to say. What is the electrical system?
Imagine you like come and then like the Christmas tree just like goes out. You ruin Christmas for the whole family. Think twice.
You know what? Be like the gay deaf brother from the Family Stone and stay at an inn instead of your family's home.
Exactly. All right, we have a voicemail.
Which this has nothing to do with Christmas, but we're going to let it fly.
Hi. Heated rivalry. You obviously, it's taken over the internet, especially queer media, queer Instagram, queer everything. We can't stop talking about these horny, horny hockey players. And it's not a bad show. And the sex scenes are really not bad. They're actually amazing. And we need you guys to comment on it. I know Lauren is like getting off to this for sure. Chelsea probably is too. I would love to hear your thoughts. Okay, bye.
Well, this listener clocked us, didn't he?
Okay, but I just want to say, our listeners have been telling us to watch this show for a while, and they've been framing it in a very specific way, which is like, it's a gay hockey show, but it's not really about sports, so you don't really need to fuck with sports to watch it. None of you guys told us that it was gay porn. And if you did, we would have prioritized it.
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of the fuckettes on Patreon, we're framing it in this way. You're right that we're like, I know you don't fuck with hockey, but would you consider watching Heated Rivalry? Guys, you should have explained it as, hey, have you ever wondered what it would be like if Greg Araki directed the most high-budget CW show ever?
But, like, Greg Araki films have more plot than this. Like, this is basically just fucking.
Also, I don't know, have you watched, are you caught up?
I've watched up to episode 4.
Okay, same. The time jumps are insane. Like, this is an 8-year situationship, which I did not realize.
Yeah, it's some Brokeback Mountain shit.
So there are a couple of crazy things about this. So immediately when I saw the show, I was like, this is fan fiction that someone turned into an original romance novel. And I am correct. So the author Rachel Reed originally imagined this as Marvel fan fiction in the Stucky fandom, Chelsea. I'm sure you're aware. That's when Steve Rogers and Bucky Barnes have sex with each other.
Oh, God. This just got way less hot.
And then she reworked it as original fan fiction. But Heated Rivalry is actually the second book in the Game Changer series. So there are 5 or 6 books. This is the second book and the only book where 2 hockey players fuck each other. I guess the rest of the books in this series is a hockey player and someone else, like a hockey player and a barista.
Right. I saw the barista episode, of course.
I mean, yeah, I love this show, which is not surprising. What I'm more surprised by is that this show turns you on.
Yeah, as I texted you when I first started watching this, I could almost masturbate to this. And I'm not one of those lesbians that's like into gay male porn. I don't watch it ever, but I did a little research, and according to recent data from Pornhub, women account for 47% of the viewers of gay male porn on that website. And that is insane.
I mean, that checks out.
I mean, it's not insane in the sense that, like, it's common that people are aroused by random shit that doesn't necessarily directly relate to their own sex lives, especially with women. And also, gay porn is like the only sort of mainstream pornography that isn't filmed for heterosexual men. So it makes sense that like women would be into that.
It's the male gaze.
It's the male gaze. It's the power dynamics. It's people think that gay male porn seems more consensual.
Well, I was going to make the joke that the male gaze is preferable.
Also, with lesbians, it's like there's no masculinity in lesbian porn because lesbian porn is always like what you imagine in your head.
You mean quite literally the things we make up in our head or?
No, lesbian porn is always just very like femmy women with implants and, you know, just like porn.
Yeah, they haven't been able to figure out that genre of pornography, and it's kind of astounding.
Well, I think with gay men, it's like gay men are like producing and starring in their own pornography, whereas lesbians never did that in a mass way.
Right.
So therefore, they have no porn to watch, so they end up watching gay porn by default.
Can we talk about the 2 actors who look like Sean Cody porn stars?
Yeah.
We have Hudson Williams and Connor Story. Connor Story plays the Russian guy, and he is not Russian.
He's so hot. It's wild.
That's who you would go for?
That's who I would go for, yes.
What I find interesting is that they were doing an interview, and I think it was Hudson Williams who was like, queer people should tell queer stories. And then Connor Story was the one who was like, you know, I'm going to keep my personal life personal, and I think it should stay that way. And I'm like, oh my God, he's a closeted straight man.
Is he?
I don't know, but it's just so funny to see what I believe is the reverse of like so many closeted gay male actors have sort of been like, I don't talk about my personal life, but it's like funny that a straight man kind of has to do that. That's what I assume when a man on a very popular gay romance show is like, I'm gonna keep my love life private. It's like, you don't want to disappoint the gay audience.
No, of course not. But I think the thing about the show that is really key to its success is the fact that the guys have chemistry with each other. And in recent years, I feel like a lot of people have cast gay shows based on what actors are gay and what actors aren't gay, and not like what actors have chemistry with each other.
And I think that that extends to, if I may speak on the het side of things, I do think there has been a sense of casting, you are right, in the last 10 or 15 years where it's like, let's get the most famous people together and instead of casting for people that have like bonkers chemistry together.
Yeah, the chemistry is like palpable watching this show. And the way the sex scenes are shot, like they're shot very well.
Not according to Jordan Firstman. Did you see that?
What did he say?
Jordan Firstman, a fellow HBO Max star, did an interview where he was like, you know, I just don't think that that's how gay men have sex. And again, I'm para-quoting, but like that's essentially, he was like, you know, on I Love LA, we show much more diversity of how gay men have sex. And then he immediately had to walk that statement back.
Well, yeah, I get it. Heated rivalry isn't realistic in that, like, someone's ass isn't always lit, like, in real life.
Right.
Also, with I Love LA, there hasn't been a ton of sex with his character. It's just you just kind of see, like, routine, like, 5 a.m. Grindr hookups.
That's what I was more confused by was, again, I'm pretty caught up on I Love LA, but I'm like, there hasn't been a ton of gay sex that he's been doing.
Wait, actually, there was that one episode where he found that sex tape about his ex or something, and that felt more real. But Heated Rivalry is like, it's not trying to be real. It's a soap opera slash Cinemax.
It started as fan fiction about what would it be like if Sebastian Stan and Chris Evans had sex.
Fan fiction written by a lesbian, which I was shocked to learn. I also didn't realize that a lesbian wrote Red, White, and Royal Blue, which is insane.
Chelsea, 2026, are you going to start getting into the homosexual romance genre?
I'm good, boo. I'm good. But I really appreciate the show. I'm excited to keep watching it.
Honestly, it's the one thing keeping me going. I'm back to discuss one of our favorites, Jones Road Beauty, and I said our because I'm not alone in doing this ad read today. Chelsea is here with me.
I'm here because I love discussing brands that I already use, and I love Jones Road because it is for a woman that wants a simple makeup routine. It was founded by the legendary makeup artist Bobby Brown, and the products that I use the face pencil, which is basically like a concealer stick that you sharpen. It's like a chubby little stick, and that's what I use for like my under eye and stuff. And then I use their foundation, which it's not a heavy foundation. It's not high coverage. It has this like really insane consistency. Actually, it's almost more like whipped frosting or something. Like it's, you have to get used to it, but it's like, it's very effective. It looks like skin. And that's what I've been using for the last year or so.
See, I'm personally a Miracle Balm girl because I love a multitasking item because you can use it as a tint, a blush, a bronzer, a highlighter. You can put it on the cheeks. You can put it on the lips. And you know what, Chelsea? Why don't you throw it on the eye as well? I do that sometimes.
On my eyelids, not the eyeball.
Thank you for clarifying.
If you are curious about Jones Road or want to give the gift of Jones Road this holiday season, they have launched a very cute holiday trio collection. There's the party kit, which includes an eyeshadow stick, a gel liner, an exclusive little Miracle Balm shade.
There's the mini lip kit. There's also a fragrance trio. All five limited edition kits in the collection are trios that include new holiday shades, products, and packaging. They make the perfect gift for beauty lovers, for someone just starting out with makeup, or perhaps your podcast partner who loves Jones Road Beauty already, and maybe you haven't gotten them a present yet.
I haven't gotten you a present yet, but that's another story. This holiday season, simplify your routine with makeup that's clean, strategic, and multifunctional. And do not miss out on their limited edition holiday sets. They won't be here for long, and once they're gone, they're gone. Also, as a treat for our listeners, you'll get a free cool gloss on your first purchase when you use code OUTFIT at checkout. Just head to jonesroadbeauty.com and use code OUTFIT at checkout. After you purchase, they will ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them that our show sent you. Okay, next question. Have you seen Patti LaBelle's unhinged rendition of This Christmas?
The answer is no. I had not seen this before. And if you're like us and had not seen this clip, let's just play it now. Hang all the mistletoe. I'm gonna get to know you better. It's Christmas. We're my background singers. Woo! Oh, baby, baby. And it's the wrong words on the cue cards. I don't know the song. It's Christmas. Because I don't have the right words and I have no background singers. Oh, I don't. Woo! Look,
it's so funny.
Look, as someone who has been plagued by technical difficulties during a live show, I feel for her. But I don't know if you watched the entire clip. So we should explain. This was for the 1996 National Tree Lighting Ceremony. This clip is on YouTube. It seems to come from C-SPAN. The comedy starts from second one because the person introducing Patti LaBelle, you just see Patti LaBelle walk on stage at the wrong time while she's still being introduced and do this face like, oops.
I also love how She doesn't know any of the words to this song aside from This Christmas. And the fact that she has to start making up lyrics and also talking directly to the audience, it gives it like a cabaret quality unintentionally that's really magical, I think.
Well, also because she's singing on the National Mall or something like that. Like, the audience is, I don't know, 30 feet away from her. So it keeps cutting to the crowd who really don't sense that there are any technical difficulties. Like, there's just a bunch of kids in the crowd just smiling like, whatever, I guess.
She's also wearing like a very glamorous, like deep brown, like satin or like a thick caftan. It looks warm.
But seriously, where are her backup singers?
They come in midway through the performance and they're like sort of like an uncomfortably far distance away from her on stage when they do come.
I guess the inference is she was backstage, did not see her backup singers, were like, well, I guess they're already on stage. I should probably get out there. Oops, wasn't supposed to come out yet. I guess we're supposed to glean that if she had backup singers, she could have parroted what they were singing, so that not having the cue cards would have been okay.
Look, everyone failed Patti LaBelle during that performance.
Including Patti LaBelle. Come on.
Well, she did the best that she could considering she doesn't know one word to that song.
Wouldn't you just glance, maybe even on the car ride over to this tree lighting, what the lyrics to This Christmas were?
Yeah, it's true. Also, I can't remember if I've ever mentioned this on the pod before, but the most glamorous celebrity that I've ever seen, like, out on the streets, like not at an event, is Patti LaBelle. Like, I was walking by Barney's one time, RIP, and she came out of the main entrance in a black skirt suit with sunglasses, looking like the richest person I've ever seen in my life. And there were two guys carrying Barney's bags behind her. And then they all like got into this like black Escalade or something. It was so fab.
Well, she needed to go on a shopping trip.
I can't believe this happened in 1996. And up until yesterday, I was completely unaware.
Do you think she thinks about this every Christmas, or she's completely forgotten that this has happened?
She should do it again for old time's sake. All right. Question we got from Instagram. I need Chelsea and Lauren's outfit deets from the holiday party. So I had a Christmas party this past Saturday. You came.
I came. I got drunk, which delighted you to no end.
I know. I haven't seen Lauren get drunk in like, when was the last time? Since I think my 40th birthday. And that was like a year and a half ago.
Right. When Morty was conceived.
Right.
Quite literally. Yeah, I think it's probably a good thing that you haven't seen me drink since then. I think actually people would commend me for that.
I don't know. I love to see you get loose. But more importantly, what were you wearing?
I wish we had a Real ad this week because my outfit was completely from the Real. I wore a Alaya black shirt dress and this long white skirt from La Agency, whatever.
L'Agence.
L'Agence.
Well, I actually don't even know what that is. It looked fab. We actually kind of had a similar silhouette going.
I've realized, and multiple people were like, you know what? The long skirt looks good on you. So 2026, no more short skirts. Certainly no more knee-length skirts, only long skirts.
I think you should still wear short skirts, but I'm glad that you're wearing long skirts. It looks good on you.
We should say I also capped off the outfit with gloves, which I have to say I thought was going to be a divisive sartorial choice. But immediately the first thing everyone said to me was like, I love your gloves.
The gloves were great. Gloves make such a statement.
I then also got very cold at your Christmas party.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
And I just started wearing a blanket you had on your chair, and you got so annoyed that you were like, what, are you really cold? If you're so cold, why don't you wear this? And you brought out a comically large Norma Kamali puffer coat that went down to the floor that I wore for the rest of the party.
It looks great. I mean, it was giving like Michelin Man, but in a chic way. It's just like a very dramatic look for a Christmas party.
And I've waited to tell you this because I knew that it would delight you to no end. but I ate shit leaving your house.
Oh, really? Like on the stairs or in the driveway?
So there were a couple other people who were leaving ahead of us and they took the stairs. Chelsea has a very steep driveway. And I was like, I've walked up and down this driveway millions of times over the years. I'll be fine. They take the stairs, immediately went down. But I knew I was falling, so I didn't even try to necessarily break my fall. My phone took the brunt of it. And I just like phone face down was like, I'm going down. It's fine. There's a lot of padding in my ass. I'll be okay.
I love the fact that your drunk ass just fully fell in my driveway. To be fair, I've done that before. I mean, once I got out of an Uber, tripped out of the car and like fell into my own recycling bin. And knocked it over. So it's like we've all had some dark moments in that driveway.
Anyway, what were you wearing at the holiday party, Chelsea?
I wore like a floor-length sequin vintage Donna Karan skirt that I also got from The Real Real and just like a cashmere sweater from Uniqlo. But I'd never worn the skirt before. The skirt like has like a elastic waistband or like a stretchy waist. And it was like a little bit too big. So it kept like slipping down and I was tripping over the hem. But thankfully, my friend Asher Levine, who's a fashion designer, was there and he fully like altered my skirt on site. He sewed me into that shit.
I remember seeing this in your kitchen.
Yeah. And then I wore some like random silver earrings that I found in Tat's studio. I have no idea what those are.
That's really where you go to for jewelry.
Oh, yeah. There's so much shit down there. It's like, for years, I just like didn't even ever go there. And now I'm glad that I've discovered the treasure trove in my very own house.
When it comes to holiday gifting, I want to give things that people really love. Beautiful, timeless pieces they'll wear for years. That's why I'm going with Quince. From Mongolian cashmere sweaters to Italian wool coats, everything is premium quality at a price that actually makes sense. Quince has something for everyone. Soft Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50 that look and feel like designer pieces. Silk tops and skirts for dressing up. Perfectly cut denim for everyday wear and outerwear that actually keeps you warm. I have several Quince cashmere pieces myself, from their classic crew neck to turtleneck, even a boat neck, and the cashmere feels incredible. She's soft, structured, and it doesn't pill. It's the kind of quality I'd normally expect from a $200 sweater, not a $50 one. And that's because every piece is made with premium materials from ethical, trusted factories and priced far below what other luxury brands charge. The craftsmanship shows in every detail, the stitching, the fit, the drape. It's elevated, timeless, and made to wear on repeat. Find gifts so good you'll want to keep them with Quince. Go to quince.com/outfit for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/outfit to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/outfit. Well, speaking of winter ensembles, I think we should play the next voicemail.
Okay, I'm a longtime listener, but I have never called in. Why is Kim Cattrall wearing Sarah Jessica Parker's Carrie's dress? Like, why is that her wedding dress? Was that purposeful? Was it accidental? Do you think she's never even seen the movie? Because I could kind of believe that. But she's wearing Carrie's dress. That's so crazy. Please give your thoughts.
Well, first off, it's a skirt suit.
It's a skirt suit. It's a Dior skirt suit, which incidentally is also the designer that made Carrie's skirt suit for her courthouse wedding with Mr. Big. So yeah, it is pretty similar when you think about it.
Even though in the film we're told it's a label-less designer. It was actually designed by Dior. I mean, I assume that Kim Cattrall is in this because she was styled by her longtime friend and Sex and the City stylist and costume designer, Patricia Field.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Oh, yeah.
She also wore a Philip Tracy hat. Philip Tracy was one of the 10 people at her wedding.
Now, that's interesting. Kim Cattrall's London lifestyle fascinates me.
I don't think that Kim or Patricia were deliberately trying to give a nod to the Sex and the City movie. I'm sure that both of them completely forgot about it, in fact.
I think so. And also, I hope this doesn't sound ageist, but for a woman of Kim's age having a courthouse wedding, like that is the most appropriate chic thing to wear to a courthouse wedding.
Yeah, it's just kind of like the standard of what you wear is a skirt suit. I feel.
Or, I don't know, maybe it was a deep cut shading to Daddy MPK. The feud continued.
Who was not invited to the wedding.
We, of course, follow Kim Cattrall, but have you been checking out? She's been documenting her honeymoon in the Maldives.
I saw the one Spawn picture from whatever resort is hosting them.
Oh, sorry, the one and only?
Also, you may be wondering, who the fuck did Kim Cattrall marry? She married this guy,
Russell Thomas.
Yes, who she met in 2016 because he was working at the BBC's radio station at the time, doing what? I have no fucking clue. They met, they apparently followed each other on Twitter, and that's how the relationship started. But other than that, I know nothing about this man.
I mean, as someone who met their husband on Instagram, I love to see it.
I'm just glad she's not with what's-his-face anymore.
Richard Remar?
No, her last husband.
Oh, the one that she wrote.
Mark Levinson.
That's right, that she wrote the orgasm book with.
Yeah, she needed a different vibe. So we got many questions that were some approximation of what would a Christmas episode of Sex and the City look like? I proposed that Lauren and I could each think of a Christmas-themed plot line for each of the girls, and I would love to know what you came up with.
Okay. Mine is set in a parallel season 4 where Carrie and Aiden are together but not engaged yet, and Trey and Charlotte are still together, and Charlotte and Trey have decided to host a Christmas Eve dinner for all of the girls and their partners.
Okay.
So Carrie and Aiden have made a pact not to get each other Christmas presents, but a Christmas present from Big arrives that sends Aiden into a jealous spin. And there's a note that says, "Hey, kid, don't open this until Christmas Day." Oh, I have more. Miranda treks to Queens to pick up a cheesecake for Charlotte's dinner that she's heard about in the New York Times, only to run into Steve. They have a very before sunset vibe. Miranda contemplates if she's made a mistake breaking up with Steve. They stop outside of Steve's ma's house, and Steve invites her up for Christmas dinner, but she declines. And as she stands on the subway platform, she goes to run after Steve because she realizes she wants to be with him, only to drop the cheesecake on the platform. She, of course, screams, "Fuck." Samantha is giving back by hosting a charity event for the Boys and Girls Club. She, of course, has the hots for the Santa there, guest star Henry Rollins.
Great.
She takes on the role of Mrs. Claus to flirt with Santa, only to learn that this Santa is having menage a trois with Santa's little helpers, aka the elves. So because of Miranda and Samantha's storyline, they are unable to show up to Charlotte and Trey's Christmas Eve dinner. So it is just Aiden and Carrie and Charlotte and Trey.
So awkward.
Well, it gets even more awkward when Aiden learns that Trey got rid of the wedding bench that he made for them for their wedding because Bunny said it didn't match the decor.
Love that.
All right, that's all I got.
Okay, in my Christmas episode, it's a Christmas Eve episode. Samantha wants Smith Jared to dress up like Santa for sexual role play purposes, but then he gets arrested scaling her building on Christmas Eve.
Okay, so it's a season 6 episode.
Miranda and Steve find them in a Gift of the Magi-esque gift-giving situation.
Okay.
Charlotte is spiraling about being single on Christmas, so her and Anthony go and see the Nutcracker at Lincoln Center, but then they run into Charlotte's college boyfriend, who is gay now and has recently gotten married in Canada.
Wait, so this is a parallel season 6 where Charlotte and Harry are not together.
I haven't really thought about it in terms of timing, Lauren.
Okay.
And lastly, Carrie shows up to Mr. Big's apartment dressed like a Rockette and he doesn't give a shit.
Yeah, that checks out. That woman has a whole host of costumes.
I could also see a Carrie and Big plot line where she gets kind of like turned off of him because he's a bit of like a Scrooge and a workaholic on Christmas. He'd probably like stand her up to the New York Stars Christmas party.
That all checks out. I feel like we got a question that was something about like, would Samantha do the PR for Big's holiday party or something like that?
I don't think Big's throwing a holiday party.
No, you're right. He's got a little Scrooge in him. One of us should have done a Christmas Carol, but with like Sex and the City characters. Like Carrie is visited by the ghost of Christmas past, present,
and future. In a Carrie Diaries crossover episode. And just like that crossover episode when you think about it. That's her past and her future.
Well, when Netflix finally buys Warner Brothers, we'll pitch them this AI episode.
Okay, we have a voicemail.
Hi, Lauren. Hi, Chelsea. My question for you is, if you were in a Secret Santa gift exchange with a limit of $100, what would you get the women on Sex and the City? Not during And Just Like That, but how they were back in the day, but using like today's presents and today's $100. Thank you so much. I love the show. Happy holidays to you and all the fuckettes.
Thank you for clarifying the details of this theoretical scenario. Okay, what are we getting, Charlotte?
I thought the home court steeped rose set, which has the surface cleaner, the hand wash, and I believe the lotion. You turned me on to home court, which is Courtney Cox's home goods line. The steeped roses actually smells like roses, not the fake rose smell. And that clocks in at $78.
See, I thought I would give her those like Gohar World, like rubber kitchen gloves that have like the little like lace cuffs on them. Or the reissued original Martha Stewart Entertaining book, which came out this year.
That's very good. I'm not going to lie. Two of my presents do go over budget slightly.
Okay, so you fucked this up is what you're saying. What are we getting for Miranda?
Okay, so here's one of the things that goes slightly over budget, but hopefully you will understand why. Harry and David does a dessert of the month club. So for 3 months at $129.99, we could get Miranda a cake of the month for 3 months.
Okay, that's nice.
There we go.
That's only $29 over budget. See, I was going to buy Miranda that like phone brick thing.
Oh.
So she can brick her phone. I too have bought one of those. I've never used it because I'm addicted to my phone, but I'm thinking about it in the new year.
Oh, yeah. I used to have that box that you would put your phone in and like it would set a lock.
See, that's like unsafe though, because the brick at least just like removes the apps that you don't like. You can still like call 911 if you need to.
Right.
Samantha.
I thought that I would get her a selection of stuff from my friend Eva's company, Mod, which is a sexual wellness company. So maybe I would get Samantha the Vibe at $52 and a lubricant, perhaps.
See, my thought was that like Samantha probably doesn't want stuff, so I would just get her a nice bottle of champagne.
That's good. But you know under $100?
Yeah, you can buy a bottle of champagne for under $100. What kind of champagne are you buying?
Well, you're saying a good bottle of champagne.
Yeah, like a nice like $75 bottle.
All right. That is, by the way, Samantha's definitely regifting that. I feel that in my bones. And to be fair, Samantha would probably regift my vibrator anyway.
I don't know. I think that sexual wellness products are obviously good for her, but
Samantha just to me has regifter vibes.
For sure. That's my whole point because she doesn't actually want anything. What are we getting for Carrie?
Okay. Again, I went slightly over budget, but by $50. An Elsa Peretti trinket tray, which to be fair, you could get a vintage one probably for less than $100.
See, I'm just getting this bitch a Diptyque candle. I'm keeping it simple. We know she likes them. No one wants to buy them. Everyone just wants to be given them. So I'm doing Carrie that solid. I love perfume. I love collecting perfume. But I will admit that I've made some regrettable choices in the past. I have multiple bottles of perfume that I will never finish in my life. They just sit there collecting dust. And that is why Micro Perfumes is so great, because you can test drive fragrances from Tom Ford, Louis Vuitton, and Prada without overcommitting.
This actually makes so much sense because there are so few bottles that I've actually finished in my life, yet you pay for the entire bottle. Honestly, it's incredibly wasteful.
Well, there's a big difference between liking the scent of a perfume in a retail environment and actually wearing it on a regular basis. And sometimes you just don't know what you're in for.
Here's how it works. Microperfume lets you sample luxury fragrances in pocket-sized vials. You get the true high-end experience, but on your terms. They sell designer brands for a fraction of the traditional retail price. These are not dupes, they are not knockoffs, and they have over 500 fragrances in stock. I've been playing around in the Tom Ford universe because because those fragrances are so expensive. And Chelsea, I don't know if I'm a fucking Fabulous girl or I'm a Lost Cherry girl. And with micro perfumes, I get to figure that out.
You could even be both at the same time if you wanted to be. Go crazy.
What are you wearing?
Well, I am a Glossier You loyalist. Like, I wear that when I'm not really dressing up, which is most of the time, and I just want to smell clean. And I did see that micro perfume stocks that. I also love Portrait of a Lady by Frederick Malle a lot, and that's expensive. That's like $300 a bottle. But at micro perfumes, you can get a sample for $7. So very reasonable. See if you're into it.
So why blindly commit to a $200 bottle? Find your scent soulmate today and get up to 60% off at microperfumes.com/outfit. That's microperfumes.com/outfit for up to 60% off. Microperfumes, real scents, no regrets.
Next question. Let's talk about Sarah Jessica Parker's Google commercial. Guys, did you see this?
We should clarify. It is a Google AI commercial. And she's obviously in the ad. I know it's very trite to be like, this ad looks like AI, but they've put in post-production whatever filter that they do put on AI-generated photos, that like yellow-brown hue, where she doesn't look real in the ad.
I don't know. To me, when I saw this, I was like, it's wild that like, just for the rest of her life, probably, she's going to have to do ads that are like, Sex and the City callbacks without actually infringing on their IP, which, to be fair, we also have to do all the time.
See, I was thinking about that. I think you're referencing this specific part of the commercial.
I'm shopping for an outfit that has a classic holiday New York City vibe, perfect for a friend's downtown party. I wonder what this would look like on me.
So that is Sarah Jessica Parker using, I assume, a Google phone and the Google AI search function. But to us, that is a Carrie Bradshaw-esque voiceover. But I realize, like, that is just her voice. If she reads words with a certain intent, it just sounds like Carrie Bradshaw doing a voiceover.
But it's also the way it's filmed. Like, so much Sarah Jessica Parker advertising takes place on a New York City street. She is in like a little outfit, although, ooh, those silver ankle boots, not very Carrie, but whatever.
Oh no, that silhouette is a very Sarah Jessica Parker silhouette.
See, I know she likes an ankle boot, but a metallic silver ankle boot with a block heel? That's what the problem is. It's the combination of the silver and the block heel. But of course, no one else is fixating on this.
Well, what I'm fixating on is just the cognitive dissonance to go in 1 year from being a judge for the Booker Prize and then doing a Google AI ad. Because this woman is clearly a Luddite. Like, she's been on record talking about her dislike of technology. So she's clearly doing this for the money.
Well, yeah, of course. She also did ads for that random, like, gambling app a while back.
That is always the weirdest thing when I see celebrities. There was that ad that was like Candy Crush, but it felt like gambling that somehow got Lisa Kudrow and Courtney Cox to do it. It's like, guys, I'm pretty sure that you guys get residual checks. Like, Sarah Jessica Parker, Lisa Kudrow, Courtney Cox, these are people that are the last generation of like actually getting good money residual checks. Like, why are you doing this?
Yeah, I hear you. But with Sarah Jessica Parker, I understand how people are like, how much money does this person need? But I do fear that because she has like 10,000 siblings, like how many siblings does she have? I forget.
I believe she's one of eight.
She's probably like taking care of like eight full families.
Well, yes. And all of her siblings who are, I'm sure, of retirement age. Yeah, I mean, I do understand why she in particular is doing this ad.
Also, people from big families like that, they tend to like have big families themselves. So she could have like 20 nieces and nephews whose college education she's paying for.
Do you think each year there's like a rock paper situation between her and Matthew Broderick where it's like, am I cashing in on being Carrie Bradshaw for an ad this year, or are you cashing in being Ferris Bueller for a Super Bowl ad this year? It's got to be one of us.
It's always one of them. It's usually both of them. I don't know. I'm sure that there are some people that are like, ew, she's doing ads for AI. But like, guys, I'm sorry. Like, the Google AI search like actually works.
Okay.
It solved the problem
of
Google searches not giving you the information that you need.
Oh, the fact that you need to type into Google whatever you're asking plus the word Reddit?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, diving back into Christmas-themed questions, what are your top New York City holiday activities? It's been a minute since I've been in New York around Christmas time, so I don't know if I'm the best person to answer this. But if I were in New York City around the holidays, I feel like, I mean, I would do this any time of year, but afternoon tea at the Russian Tea Room?
Yeah, Russian Tea Room is perfect for the holidays.
Pretty magical.
You also need, like, a restaurant that doesn't have many windows, I think, during the holidays.
Because of seasonal depression?
No, just because it's cozier.
All right, what would your recommendations be?
Okay, well, it's looking at the windows at the department stores.
So department store windows, yes. Restaurant windows, no.
Yeah, exactly. Look at the Bergdorf's windows. Printemps also is very Christmassy. Go have a drink at the bar there. Have a drink at Bergdorf's. I went to both of those places when I was in New York for Thanksgiving. I also love to go to Joe's Pub. I love Sandra Bernhard's New Year's Eve show. I love Justin Bond's Christmas show. John Waters, Dina Martina usually have Christmas shows in New York that are really fun to go to. And yeah, see the Nutcracker at Lincoln Center. That's like the best Christmas thing you can do. All right. Cuntiest Christmas movie character. If we mean cunty in the gay sense, I'm going with Christine Baranski's character in The Grinch. And if we mean cunty in the mean sense, it's Rachel McAdams in The Family Stone.
I absolutely agree with you. If we mean cunty in the former sense, as you defined it, I was going to say Carol Kane as the ghost of Christmas present.
Yes.
In Scrooged. But also, just a cunty Christmas adjacent character. Every Christmas, I rewatch a particular episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's from an early Curb season where Larry has a pubic hair stuck in his throat the entire episode.
Of course.
And Cheryl's family is coming to town. She has made cookies that are a recreation of the nativity scene. Larry accidentally eats those cookies and then hires a real life nativity scene that he sees in Santa Monica and then gets in a fight with Joseph, and that unlocks the pubic hair. That to me is a pretty cunty Christmas related character of sorts.
All right. Stepping away from Christmas for a second, thoughts on the Vanity Fair Trump administration portraits. These photos were by Christopher Anderson.
Now this is what the resistance looks like.
I loved this just because I'm so glad that we're talking about photography at all. And I'm glad that Vanity Fair has done something really zeitgeisty that people are talking about. Like, I feel like not since the Caitlyn Jenner cover.
Right.
Have people been talking this much about anything in Vanity Fair?
So for those who have not seen it yet, a lot of the Trump administration 2.0, like Stephen Miller and Caroline Leavitt, and some woman I had previously never heard of, Susie Wiles, Marco Rubio, were profiled. And
Susie Wiles is the chief of staff, by the way.
I mean, not a lip among any one of those people, but they basically got played by Vanity Fair. They thought that it was going to, for some reason, be a glowing editorial. And I guess they never thought about the fact that just because they were shot with maybe a 50 millimeter lens, that just in post, they could zoom in on their faces.
Well, why would they think that these would be the portraits? Especially like if you're going to contrast these with like the famous Annie Leibovitz portraits that she did of
the Bush administration,
George Bush Jr. and Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. That was such an iconic cover.
Right. That really legitimized that administration and what they were doing during the Iraq War. And this is sort of the reverse.
They feel bad for what they did there.
But this is literally a funhouse mirror version of that because the editorials are not glowing. I mean, Caroline Leavitt, I don't know what she was thinking because it's very clear that she's just had filler put in her lip because you see every injection site in her lip.
Yeah, it's like, did she do it that day? I don't even know how that happens. And you also see in this close-up, you see her sort of like badly penciled in eyebrows. And I feel like this image is so successful, like on a conceptual level, because it is all about artifice and sort of the fakeness of the lips and the eyebrows and stuff. It does sort of relate to her role as a press secretary, where it's her job to put this positive PR spin on the most blatantly evil behavior.
It's also funny because this administration loves to rile against, you know, the liberal media and all of this. And they clearly, all of them, right? It's not just like, oh, Caroline Leavitt got a bad cover on Vanity Fair. Like, it is half of his administration that went into this thinking that they were going to be made to look good.
But why would they think that they wouldn't? But it all makes sense that they would be presented in this way because this administration lacks decorum in a major way. And I feel like these photographs really convey that visually, whether it's these close-ups where you sort of see the cracks in the facade, or it's just these images that were shot in the White House where you see lampshades that are askew,
right,
a rumpled blanket, and you see outlets in the wall with cords, and like there's no staging, there's no removing stuff like that in post. So you do see like, and you see the fact that they're these very kind of ordinary people in a way.
Well, it's very unvarnished and it shows them as the ghouls that they are.
Yeah. But I do find it interesting whose appearance we're allowed to make fun of, right? Like, we can make fun of Caroline Leavitt because she's a deeply creepy bitch, obviously. But like, I don't know. I find it interesting how people, like liberals, are always talking about how like fat and ugly Trump is. But these are the same people that are like, yes, Lizzo, we hate fat shaming.
I mean, I think who got it the least worst would be J.D. Vance, especially if you know the meme of J.D. Vance's bloated face. Like, this is practically, I mean, a beautiful portrait of him.
I think that J.D. Vance, like, closely cropped photo is actually a better photo than the Caroline Leavitt one, like in a technical sense.
Out of all of these people, I feel like Stephen Miller should have been like, you know what? I'm probably not going to be photographed like a beauty queen.
Well, also like the one of Marco Rubio, like standing in profile where it's like, he's obviously like looking for his mark on the floor or something.
Oh, these are the test photos.
These are the test photos. Or like the one of Susie Wiles where it's like, you can almost see her eyes responding to the flash. Like it's the first photo they took of her. But I think this really speaks to like how powerful photo editors are, because I'm sure there are a million photos of these people where they look
decent.
Yes, they look decent. They look like they are an authority.
I know there's been a lot of talk, obviously, of how do we resist this? And I love when people play within the system. Like Vanity Fair was like, hey, we'd love to do a profile of you guys. And they were like, this is great. Everyone thinks we're incredible.
Well, it wasn't really a profile of all of them. It was really just Susie Wiles that they were interviewed. I mean, they talked about the Trump administration as a whole, but like she said some truly insane things. I didn't read the second part of the interview. I just read the first part. But like even just saying that Trump has the personality of an alcoholic is like an insane thing to say about a president who you work for.
Well, so the writer Chris Whipple has been doing interviews because, of course, people are like, how did you get this kind of unrestricted access? And he had initially pitched it, at least to Susie Wiles, that he was doing a book. So that's probably the reason that she spoke to him so many times. But he's like, all of this was on the record. And when I said that it was going to be a Vanity Fair article, they were all open and down to do this.
She also just straight up is like, J.D. Vance is a conspiracy theorist.
I mean, the least worst thing about J.D. Vance.
But it's clear that her and Trump have like a very, very close relationship. And I'm fascinated by it. But she, of all people, like, she may not look as crazy in the close-ups as Caroline Leavitt, but, like, that one wide shot of them all sitting at the table where Susie is in the center, like, looking like, I don't even know.
She has a blank stare as if, like, Grandma, I think it's time for memory care.
Yeah, and, like, that's not how she looks all the time. Like, I haven't seen her speak publicly that often. I saw a clip of her speaking at Charlie Kirk's funeral. I'm like, okay, this bitch looks, like, normal. she's just like a normal, like, religious Republican woman of a certain age. I mean, she's not normal given the circumstances of her job, obviously, but
I would like to dig in more why you were watching Charlie Kirk's funeral, but we have other questions to answer.
I watched the whole thing. No, I'm joking. I did not. I just like dipped in and out a couple of times. I was just curious.
To be fair, it was on every news station all day long.
Yeah, it really took over.
And yet no one mentions him now. Except for that insane Barry Weiss interview with Erica Kirk.
And that Charlie Kirk song that's still in my head somehow.
Oh boy.
This episode is also brought to you by Mubi, the global film company that champions great cinema. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there's always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected so you can explore the best of cinema. Truly, every week they have a new film that is bound to be my new favorite of the year, and this week it's The Mastermind. I've been excited about this film since it was announced, and it did not disappoint. It is the latest film by Kelly Reichardt, who did First Cow and Showing Up, and this is her take on a heist film. Maybe most importantly, the film stars Josh O'Connor, my hall pass of the year, probably your hall pass of the year. In this film, see him as you've never seen him before, as an unemployed family man and amateur art thief who sets out on his first heist. With the museum case and accomplices recruited, he has an airtight plan, or so he thinks. Think of it like the Louvre heist, but set in the Massachusetts suburbs in the 70s and directed by an indie film master. This film also stars Alana Haim, always happy to see her in a film, as well as Gabby Hoffman, who a Pilates instructor once said I looked like. The Mastermind and so many other great films are now streaming on Mubi in the US. To stream the best of cinema, you can try Mubi free for 30 days at Mubi.com/everyoutfit. That's MUBI.com/everyoutfit for a whole month of great cinema for free.
Question from Instagram. Have either of you watched Fanny and Alexander? Thoughts on that, as well as Ingmar Bergman?
Yes, I have seen Fanny and Alexander, but not for almost 20 years. And also, I've only ever seen like the theatrical cut. I've never seen the full like 5-hour TV miniseries. What about you?
I have not seen Fanny and Alexander. I feel like I need to brush up on my Bergman because obviously I've seen Seventh Seal.
I saw Seventh Seal like in my high school film class.
Yeah. I mean, I saw it in a college film class, but my introduction to Bergman is from, why am I blanking on it? Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. If you remember, spoiler alert, when they die and go to hell or they are in purgatory, there is a version of death that they play various games with. Not chess, but like Battleship.
I know, once you finally see The Seventh Seal, you understand so many other movies, truly. So many Woody Allen movies, of course, are like directly referencing Ingmar Bergman.
But of course, Persona is a film we love. A bedrock foundation for our favorite genre of film, glamorous women having nervous breakdowns.
Well, you really should see Fanny and Alexander. It is very Christmassy. It starts at Christmas, and like a Swedish Christmas just hits different.
Of course.
Like they really like know what the fuck is up. It's magical. Of course, it becomes a sad tale about grief and child abuse and stuff like that. But like it is an epic, epic film. We should really try and see it in a theater because that's a great Christmas activity, actually. Find out if there's an art house theater in your town that is playing Fanny and Alexander.
Unfortunately, all of our art house theaters are kind of owned by Quentin Tarantino, so something tells me that Fanny and Alexander won't be playing.
See, I've seen a fair amount of the Ingmar Bergman movies. I like got really obsessed with them when I was in my early 20s, but I haven't rewatched many of them just because it's like they do hit you so hard emotionally. Like, I don't know if there are films that have affected me so deeply as Ingmar Bergman's films, so it's not something that I feel like I want to compulsively rewatch, although I've seen Cries and Whispers a few times because I've seen that in a theater a couple of times. And that visually it gives Christmas, like the interiors give Christmas, but nothing Christmas about it. It is about fucked up family dynamics, though.
I've been wanting to fill out watching the filmographies of directors that just I've missed. Like Ingmar Bergman is one, like finishing out his filmography. Hitchcock is another person. I would say I would make it a goal for 2026, but with all my free time with this baby, you know what? Maybe the baby will fuck with some Ingmar Bergman. Be good for him.
Oh my God, my friend Joanna, I think she was at a screening of Happiness, like the Todd Solondz film, and she realized that the people sitting behind her, they were all like film bros. They all admitted that they had never seen one Alfred Hitchcock movie.
Oh, sorry. I gasped because I thought you were going to say they brought a child to a screening of Happiness.
I mean, no, that would be fucked up. But like the idea that people haven't seen Hitchcock, like that's like the most like fucked up thing I've ever heard in my life. Also, before we move on from Ingmar Bergman, I feel like you and I, like we owe him a great deal of gratitude because I don't know if there is any other single director that is more committed to making movies about like the mental health struggles of women.
Right.
Like he actually low-key invented the glamorous women having nervous breakdowns genre. I mean, Persona, Cries and Whispers, Face to Face is another one that is very that.
I think we need to add to this genre as we build the narrative of glamorous women having nervous breakdowns. He's the patron saint.
He is. Also, he loved Sex and the City.
What? It's hard for me to envision that his timeline overlaps with Sex and the City.
It does. He was a fan of Sex and the City. And I'm sure he loved Charlotte because she's the sort of like repressed psycho woman that would be at the center of one of his films.
Right.
Anyway, hard pivot, but thoughts on Miss Piggy's Santa Baby cover,
which we used to open this week's episode.
Sorry, Eartha Kitt, this is the best version.
I mean, I relate to the fact that Miss Piggy is not the greatest singer.
It's such a perfect cover because, as we know, Miss Piggy is living in a material world and she is a material girl. Lyrically, this song just sounds like shit that she would say already. Also, the way they change up some of the lyrics, like when she says, think of all the fun I've missed, think of all the froggies that I haven't kissed, that's iconic. This is always on my Christmas party playlist.
Don't I know it? All right, what feels like another hard pivot.
Oof.
This week, I'm sure everyone has heard, we lost the director, Rob Reiner.
I mean, we didn't just lose him, he was murdered.
By his son, allegedly, we have to say allegedly.
Along with his wife.
Michelle Singer Reiner. There's obviously been this very understandable outcry from Trump's tweet about Rob Reiner's death, but did you know that Michelle Singer Reiner was the photographer who photographed the portrait that's on the cover of The Art of the Deal?
Oh, wow. No, I did not know that. I mean, I knew she was a photographer.
Somebody tells me Trump did not know that either. Anyway, we were asked, best Rob Reiner film, I assume our favorite, because I feel like best and our favorite are probably different.
I mean, best and my favorite is Misery. I'm sorry. Like, same thing.
Well, by that regard, North, best and favorite Rob Reiner film. No, I'm joking. For me, Princess Bride. I love that movie. Probably the best non-animated fairy tale film. For me, I did not know that movies could be like that. Be funny, be swashbuckling, be romantic.
See, I didn't really fuck with Princess Bride. Too nerdy.
I mean, just the breadth of his career and the fact that like he owned so many different genres and probably made the best of certain genre movies. Like he basically invented and made the best mockumentary with This Is Spinal Tap. Perhaps made one of the best coming of age films with Stand By Me.
For sure.
Created the architecture for the modern rom-com with When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah, the movies he made were films of quality, overwhelmingly so.
Well, I love when people have been talking about his career and they're like, this run, man, from 1984 to 1992, this is Spinal Tap to A Few Good Men. And I think the reason they don't want to go beyond that is because his film in 1994 was North, which I jokingly said was my favorite film. But North was a movie that was just on a lot on cable. So I was unaware that I guess this was a heavily derided film. Like it recently resurfaced. Rob Reiner reciting from memory Roger Ebert's review of the film where he said, I hated. Roger Ebert said he hated North 7 times.
See, I've never seen that movie.
It's like Elijah Wood hates his family, so he visits other families.
Until Rob Reiner died, I did completely forget about An American President. Like, I remember watching that on VHS or whatever when I was a kid, but I've never seen it since.
I mean, a real TNT banger. And I think Aaron Sorkin's only attempt at a rom-com of sorts.
Yeah.
I was unaware that Rob Reiner had directed the film Rumor Has It, which...
Me too, which I did see.
Which someone on Patreon brought up after we were talking about The Family Stone, because these two movies came out the same year, and Rumor Has It has an insane premise. It's basically Jennifer Aniston learns that her mother... basically her family is who The Graduate is based on. That her grandmother, I think played by Shirley yeah. MacLaine, is Mrs. Robinson.
Great premise.
It is a great premise. I don't think it's the greatest film.
It wasn't. We both saw it and I remember very little from it. It's a shocking crime. It's not often that celebrities get murdered. It's not often that children kill their own parents.
Let alone both parents.
Yeah. It's just...
I've not been able to stop thinking about this.
No one has. And it's all anyone in LA can talk about, truly. And it's also sad because my mother actually worked with Rob Reiner for years because he was instrumental in getting Proposition 10 passed in California, which added an additional 50-cent tax to every single tobacco product that was sold in the state. And that money was used to create an organization called First Five, which basically distributed that money to programs benefiting children under the age of five. And my mother worked for First Five. She was the one that was tasked with sort of doling out the money to programs in our county. And multiple times a year, she would have to fly to Southern California to have these meetings with Rob Reiner and like other First Five people, because he was the chairman of the board. And it was something that really meant a lot to him. And she's very upset about his death. And she said, she was like, the thing about him is just like, he was just a good person. So for someone like that, who was kind, who really cared about other people, who didn't need to do any of the shit that he did, really, like the charitable work that he did, for him to be killed in such a violent way is just so, so tragic and fucked up.
Well, yeah, you even saw his good naturedness by 10 years ago, he directed a film that was co-written by his son, the son who is now arrested for his murder, as well as his mother's murder, that was a fictionalized version of his own struggle with addiction. A lot of interview clips have resurfaced. That came from Rob Reiner's big heart of like just wanting to help his son.
Yeah. Yeah, he wanted to help children in general. Did you see the courtroom drawings of the son appearing? Look, I know that he's like clearly like come straight from a psychiatric hospital or something, but what the fuck was he wearing? I was like, this looks like a Marnie shift dress or something.
He was wearing an anti-suicide vest. I did not, again, not to make light of this, but I agree with you. I did not know that they made them in sort of caftan.
It's sleeveless. Like the arms were out. I was like, what the fuck?
I guess it's to not give them any amount of fabric that they could hang themselves with. Sorry, by the way, I'm imagining the fuckheads listening to this as they're like finishing up Christmas decorations if we're talking about anti-suicide vests and familicide.
Speaking of mental institutions, I was watching Trump like give his little speech yesterday, and he's like, there's people coming from all these countries and they're letting them out of the mental institutions and the insane asylums. I'm like, you just said the politically incorrect term for mental institution. Like, you've said the same thing.
And that's how we know he's incompetent. Nothing else.
Or is there a difference between mental institutions and insane asylums? Am I the naive one?
I don't know, but I'm realizing what our next voicemail is. And guys, you're in for it, but we're all in this together, okay? I'll just say that.
Hi, fuckheads. For you ask me anything, here's a question that I feel like Chelsea will know the answer to. So I have a wacky friend, delightful, love her. Her dad used to have a pawn shop. She saw he had these earrings that were like not coat, like they're racist. They're straight up racist and gross. And she was like, my dad cannot have these in his shop. They are like, there's some bad energy here. So she took them out of his shop so she could get rid of them, but then she doesn't know what to do with them. So she's had them in her possession for a decade. And she's like, every time we give them to other people, bad things happen to them, so we still have them. So for Christmas, I would like to help her dispose of them. How does one dispose of something that is cursed and racist? She lives in Denver, if that is helpful for you to know. Thanks for your help.
Okay, why do you think that I would know what to do with these racist ass earrings? They're like, Chelsea might know what to do. It's like, no, I'm not like constantly like disposing of racist memorabilia and setting it free or whatever.
My favorite thing is towards the end of the call when she's like, what do I do with curse? And let us not forget racist earrings.
Also, I love how she doesn't describe what makes the earrings racist. So all we can do is imagine things in our head, and whatever you guys are imagining the fuckettes at home, that's racist.
It does make me feel like the scene in Reservoir Dogs where everyone believes that they see an ear getting cut off, but you don't. And like our memories are way worse than anything you could possibly see. That's what this is, but for racism. Okay. I also love the detail of like, we're in the Denver area, if that impacts your answer.
I just need more clarification of like, we try to give them to people and then bad things happen. So you've gifted these racist earrings to someone and then their life has fallen apart and they've like put it all together. So they give you the earrings back.
Honestly, it sounds like the beginning of a Blumhouse horror film.
Look, I understand like the psychotic thought process of like, what do you do with something that you can't get rid of? Like, for example, I have this porcelain Pierrot head in my downstairs closet that I also think is cursed, and I'm scared that if I get rid of it, something bad is going to happen. I'm pretty sure that's just like OCD, though.
This feels like It Follows, but with racist earrings. Like, they're just trying to get it away from them. Here's what this call initially made me think of when I heard the racist part, not the curse part, but there was someone who was going through on TikTok their grandmother's house and they found these racist dolls, these very menstrual looking dolls that their grandmother had when she was a child. And she was like, I don't know what to do with this. And I remember there was a guy, an African-American man that had a museum with these artifacts. He was like, send me these things for this museum I have. And I could not find him. Last night I was just on TikTok searching racist dolls. So now that's in my search history, trying to find this person again. But I don't want to send this man, even if I could find him again, cursed racist earrings.
Like, it would be nice if you could connect these racist earrings with like a person of color that's into collecting racist memorabilia. But like, you can't just post on Facebook Marketplace like, hey, who wants these racist earrings?
Asterix, they are also cursed.
Okay, this is my thought, and maybe this is unhinged. Put them in a little Tupperware container and bury them in your backyard. Then if horrible things start to happen in your life, you can always like dig them up again. And if nothing happens, then you can just forget about them.
Well, I wanted to do something with the Denver detail. So I was like, I don't know, drive up to the Rocky Mountains and leave them there. They get back to Denver. They open up the glove compartment. The earrings are back there.
I'm sorry, fuck it. If you're listening to this, you got to send us a picture. Like, we need to know. We need to know what we're dealing with.
And also maybe a further clarification as to why Chelsea specifically would know how to deal with this.
Hey, white elephant could also be the solution. Just kidding.
All right. Back to a nice holiday themed question. Quite literally. In the film The Holiday, what is your theory on what realistically happens post New Year's Eve?
Because, yeah, Cameron Diaz, she can't really move to England, but she would have to because What's-His-Face has kids.
Well, obviously, for the uninitiated, which The Holiday is a Nancy Meyers film I sort of forget about for some reason, although it's always on, right? Kate Winslet and Cameron Diaz both have shitty relationships with men. They swap houses. This was like in 2005, like, whoa, I traded houses with someone on the internet. And Kate Winslet meets Jack Black. Jack Black, who is in a situationship with Shannon Sossaman, a detail I always remember.
Jack Black at a highly specific point in his career where he could be cast as the romantic lead in a rom-com. Crazy to think that happened.
Right. Cameron Diaz is a trailer editor. She goes to the small town that Kate Winslet lives in and has a romance with Kate Winslet's brother, played by Jude Law. Obviously, this listener wants us to say, yes, what happens post New Year's Eve, because the film ends with the foursome together in Kate Winslet's cottage on New Year's Eve. And I need to dive into this New Year's Eve epilogue of this film, because Honestly, I think they have a foursome the night of New Year's Eve. I don't know if you remember the way that like Cameron Diaz and Kate Winslet are whispering with each other and like staring at Jack Black. I'm like, oh, they all fuck when the credits are rolling.
I don't know. I guess Cameron Diaz could edit her trailers from anywhere, right? It seemed like she worked from home in LA.
She did. And as the film and television world got more and more international, I feel like if she had moved to London, she would have found a career editing commercials and eventually, yeah, editing trailers again. But the Kate Winslet and Jack Black situation, I don't know.
See, I feel like Kate Winslet was less tethered than Cameron Diaz.
Because she could just get a job in LA.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll never know.
But what I do know is they all had sex on New Year's Eve.
Okay. Another question we got. What is your unhinged Christmas crush? I rewatched The Santa Claus and found myself attracted to Tim Allen as Santa. That's kinky.
I'm also going to go with the film The Santa Claus, but I got to say Bernard, David Krumholtz, a teenage David Krumholtz, I definitely had a crush on, specifically as Bernard, as a Santa's little helper.
It's been a long time since I've seen that movie. I'm going to be honest. My Christmas crush, imagine if I was like Miss Claus.
I mean, I could
Mrs.
see
Mrs. Claus, excuse me.
I'm showing Chelsea a photo of Bernard from The Santa Claus.
Ooh, that's rough. The pigeon lady from Home Alone.
No, fuck off, Chelsea.
Home Alone 2, I'm sorry. I talked about her, I think, in our Family Stone VIP episode, but I'm going with the naughty secretary from Love Actually.
Ooh, but that's not unhinged. That's typical.
Like, it's pretty unhinged.
I mean, she's unhinged in that movie. No, like an unhinged Christmas crush would be like Rowan Atkinson as the guy in the department store helping Alan Rickman. That's an unhinged Christmas crush.
Okay, fine. The Abominable Snowman.
I'll take it. Do we fuck with Dior pre-fall?
I absolutely do.
Yeah.
There's something for every bitch under the sun in there. And I love it because it feels like all eras of Dior are represented in that collection. I really liked, there's like this floral scarf print dress, which reminds me of the Marc Bohan era, which is my favorite Dior. So I definitely fuck with that.
Yeah. The only thing that gives me pause is the continuing doubling down of what seems to be very expensive denim.
Yeah. But like, that's what people actually, like you're wearing jeans right now.
That is true.
And you would be wearing these crazy ass Dior jeans if you were like the kind of person that was spending like $3,000 on jeans.
Which I am not. But yeah, it's gorgeous.
I love these like peep toe mules with the CD hardware. Like that's an instant classic. And I would totally buy them if they weren't $1,200 like all shoes are now, I'm assuming.
Only time will tell.
Okay, thank you to the fuckette that asked, is Chelsea's cheilitis better? The answer is yes. I have had minor flare-ups, but not major ones. So something is moving in a positive direction, but I still don't know what triggers my cheilitis. I saw my GP about it a couple of times. She prescribed me a ton of different shit. I don't know if any of that shit worked. I've stopped taking it all now.
Yes. This question is unlocking a drunken conversation that you and I were having at the holiday party where we were really trying to talk to other people and tell them our point of view, which is that dermatologists are bullshit.
Well, yeah, because my GP was like, if this happens again, you need to see a dermatologist. And I'm like, I've never gotten an answer from a dermatologist.
Not once.
And fuckettes, I'm not saying like, obviously, if you have a like sketchy mole, like go to a dermatologist and get it looked at. I don't want to dissuade anyone from seeking medical treatment. But in all the years that I've gone to a dermatologist, I haven't even gotten an answer, let alone a treatment. Because you go into the dermatologist, they're like you could have like a mild case of rosacea or you could have like third degree burns. No idea which.
Right. They won't give you a definitive answer, but they will prescribe a $600 cream that your insurance definitely doesn't cover.
Yeah. And then they're like, could be dermatitis, could be full-blown AIDS. Just we have no way of knowing. And I'm like, why am I here? Remember those two times that I got like basically like poison oak all over my body? And they were like, yeah, we don't know if it's poison oak or if it's an allergic reaction. And we have no idea how to treat it.
My favorite question that dermatologists ask when you have a horrific rash is like, is there anything different in your life? It's like, no, I've literally been doing and eating the same things. You tell me what's going on. Look at me. What is this? And they're like, no clue. But try this cream.
Yeah, I don't know. It continues to baffle me, but hopefully it will just like continue to recede and not be a thing. But yeah, that was like really stressing me out. It's still stressing me out, but I've at least gotten through. I was thinking like, please let me not have cheilitis for my Christmas party. I was like praying to God or like old Saint Nick.
You looked gorgeous.
Okay, next question. Shrimp cocktails, chic or gross?
Depends how long the shrimp cocktail has been out for.
Yeah, I would say chic. I'm not personally like a huge fan of the shrimp cocktail, but I like the look a lot. So definitely do that. Okay, favorite side to bring or make for a holiday party? I've literally never done such a thing.
I was going to say, I mean, I feel like we should have Tatters on because she was like the Ina Garten of the party.
Yeah.
But personally for me, Fishwife does this smoked salmon with Flyby Gin chili crisp, but they have a recipe that I've made a bunch of times, which is like taking that and putting it with like cream cheese and sour cream and making this great dip with chives, like very finely chopped chives. It's always been a big hit.
Yeah, you've made that for me before.
And it's yummy.
I'll bring booze. I'll pick something up from a nice bakery and bring that. Also, bringing drugs, not the worst idea. Thankfully, someone at my Christmas party generously gifted me mushroom chocolate, and that was perfect.
It was a big hit.
All right, we have a voicemail.
Hey, ladies. It's Alex. I'm a day one listener, first-time caller. And what prompted me to finally pick up the phone and give you guys a call is that I had a run-in with Miss Chelsea last night at Sal's Place in Los Angeles. She looked so chic. I hope the listeners will hear this and believe me. Too fab. Tat was there. I was completely gagged. We cheersed with our martinis, and my life has never been the same. So happy holidays. I have a couple questions. One for you, Chell, how do you take your martini? And Lauren, too, actually, if you drink martinis, let me know. And then number two, I'm throwing a holiday party on Saturday. I saw you, Chelsea, hosted one last weekend, which looked fab. What's your number one hostessing recommendation or thought? I want the barefoot Contessa every outfit version. Love you girls so much. And it was truly a pleasure to meet you, Chell. So XOXO. Mwah.
This is so cute. I love how this call to the hotline also vaguely feels like a misconnection or something.
Well, you guys will always have Sal's.
Yes. I mean, Sal's, I have to say, Sal's reopened last month. It's a seasonal restaurant in LA that's in Provincetown the other half of the year. And I love Sal's. I am always at Sal's. Everyone should go to Sal's.
So if you are in the Los Angeles area and want to meet Chelsea Fairless, go to Sal's.
I might be at Sal's.
So how do you take your martini?
I wasn't drinking a martini. I was drinking a French 75.
That is what I was going to say is I don't know you as a martini person. I know you as a French 75 person.
Yeah. And like sometimes a French 75, because it has champagne in it, they do serve it in a sort of like a champagne coupe type glass, which
can be mistaken.
Could read as martini, but no.
I am also not a martini person. However, if I'm in an environment where people are drinking martinis, like I was at Smokehouse a couple of weekends ago having dinner with some friends and everyone ordered martinis, I will order a Cosmopolitan. Like if everyone's getting that glass shape and I don't want to feel left out, I will order a Cosmopolitan.
See, Smokehouse, that's also a good Christmassy restaurant. A steakhouse.
Make your reservations now. I'm a fan of any restaurant that takes and pressures you into buying commemorative photographs. Like, I'm always down to be like, yes, I will spend $30 for this shitty printed out digital photo.
See, we're so different because every time the photographer comes up to me at Smokehouse, I'm like, get the fuck away. I'm not doing that right now. Hard, hard pass. As for hostessing tips, I have a good one, which is like, my Christmas party, it started at 7, but as we know, no one really shows up until 8. What you have to do is force a group of like your close friends to actually show up when the party starts, like a nice configuration of people that are cool, that you feel comfortable around. Because in the past, when I've had parties, it's like no one shows up. Then me and Tat like start getting anxious about the fact that no one shows up. We drink like 3 bottles of natural wine together and are like plastered before anyone gets there. And then the first people that show up to the party are like the weirdest people that you've invited, or like the worst configuration of people that could be there at the same time.
I agree with you. I felt very honored that I got the first kind of pass of people. You were like, please come early. And so we did. And I agree with you. I think that you need to invite people in waves. Tell a certain amount of people 6:30, then another group 7, 8, and there you go. You really don't need much. A nice cheese plate. Everyone feels obligated to bring wine or something.
But you need a lot of alcohol, just even if people are bringing wine and stuff. Like, we did a Costco shop, or I made you go to Costco because I don't have a Costco membership.
Yes, after last week's episode, we took baby Morty and Tatiana, Chelsea, and I went to Costco all together. What we look like to other people, I have no idea. But Tatiana went ham. Like, she made an apple paloma where she like made the apple juice.
And that's a great Christmas drink. It's like fresh apple juice, Blanco tequila. What else was in there? I think she topped it with like a hard cider or something, and then garnished it with like a dehydrated apple and a cinnamon stick. It was really good.
See, she enjoyed hosting, although she was locked in, because I do think making, depending on the size of your party, making batch cocktails is a really great idea. Because then, like, once that runs out, people will start making their own drinks. However, she was locked into putting all the accoutrements.
Yeah, exactly. Like, she made another cocktail that involved, like, rosemary sprigs.
And people would start walking away, and she was like, wait, I gotta put ginger beer in that.
Yeah, actually, that's my other tip. It's like, don't put too much hot food out, because hot food becomes cold. No one eats it. And then you're like having to like slave away in the kitchen, like dealing with hot food. And you have to like think about it. If the chips and the dip and that shit aren't enough, then like later in the party when people are drunk, like order McDonald's, order Popeyes, like get some pizzas, like do something like that. We don't need like hot food from the jump.
I would agree. I don't know if you remember that I confided in you. One of the hot appetizers you had out were these breaded shrimp. Mm. And for the fuckettes who've been listening for a while, there was a moment, I don't know, a year or two ago, where you found an old shrimp tail in your purse and you did not remember the last time you had consumed shrimp. And so Tad and I were like, oh, this is gonna be great. Let's take one of the shrimp tails and hide them in Chelsea's purse. But then we got too drunk to remember to do it.
You should have done it. That would have been really, really funny. Okay. Moving on, someone asked, thoughts on my year of rest and relaxation being made by Yorgos?
It would be major if he did it, but I really have doubts that this film is going to make it to the big screen.
Yeah, this has never been confirmed.
It might have, but it's like, I don't need another Emma Stone-Yorgos collaboration, if that's what this is going to be.
Well, I think it's Margot Robbie's production company, I think, is the one that has the rights to the book, I believe. So I don't think it would be another Emma Stone joint. And that would be a good role for her.
I think doing a time period film that is set in the early 2000s, specifically the year 2000, 2001... I think is unbelievably hard to do accurately.
Well, I think Yorgos is perfect. I mean, not so much because of that, but more like that book has such a dark, dark sense of humor. It has a deeply shocking ending in the way that Begonia does also. And I think that
you, also the Robert Pattinson film Remember Me.
Yes. And I think that you need someone that has a really sick sense of humor to go about making a movie like this.
I think the guy that did Sick of Myself, Dream Scenario, and he did he did the film, I'm blanking on his name, but he's doing the movie that has Robert Pattinson and Zendaya about their wedding day that the teaser trailer just came out for. Like, I feel like he could do that if he wants to do an adaptation of something. He's only done original movies.
Yeah, I would support that. Okay, next question. Do you guys ever get jealous of others that are around your spouse, or do you not care? I assume you mean like people that are flirting with our spouses. because people that are around your spouse, like, no, like, I'm going to be jealous of some bitch in Trader Joe's. Like,
if I stand too close to Tatiana, you're like, whoa, 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 whoa. The answer is no. I mean, I used to be a very jealous, territorial person because I was very insecure and not in secure relationships. I mean, this is a very boring answer, but I don't feel that way in regards to Paul. I guess it also helps that we are usually around either other lesbians, married straight couples, or gay people. Like,
right.
The only time that Paul is really around...
Paul doesn't know a straight woman is what you're saying.
The only time that Paul has really, in recent memory, been around, I think, single straight women was during the merch line.
Right.
I think this more speaks to how sad and just, like, homebound our lives have become, getting married and having a child.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, and also, like, you guys both working from home, like...
We're just staring at our faces. Honestly, we long to flirt with someone. I'm joking.
See... I asked Tat, like, what's your perspective of, like, how I behave?
Oh, I bet I know the answer to this.
Well, she said, she's like, if you think that the chick is hot, then you don't care about the flirting. But if you are not attracted to the chick or you think that she's basic, then you are, like, a huge bitch and really annoying. And I'm like, okay, that sounds about right.
I'm glad you got Tatiana's perspective because I had a feeling... that if you hadn't, you were just going to be like, I'm not a jealous person at all.
Well, I don't think I am a jealous person by nature. Do I have moments of, it's not even, jealousy isn't the right word for it, though. I think it's more annoyance.
Because you don't approve of this person or their vibe.
Yeah, I don't approve of the person. I'm like, this is going nowhere. Like, anyway. We have a voicemail.
Hi, girlies. Huge fan of the pod. I'd love to hear what your guys' best and worst Christmas presents have been that you've received and or given. Okay, bye. Thank you.
I definitely know my worst Christmas present that I've ever received.
What was it?
So I was in a situationship between high school and college, like this guy that I would see when I would come back home from college. And he was a nerdy film bro, and he gave me a DVD of a film called Open Range, which is a Robert Duvall Western. And I was like, I don't get it. And he kept insisting that this was an inside joke. Like, this was a callback to a joke we had. But it wasn't. Like, I've never heard of this film previous to receiving this DVD. And I think about it to this day that I'm like, did he re-gift this? And then just gaslight me into thinking that this was an inside joke between us.
This looks like a movie for people that watch Yellowstone.
Oh, it's absolutely a proto-Yellowstone movie.
Although Annette Bening is in it.
I do still have that DVD somewhere in my house.
I don't think I've ever gotten like a truly horrific Christmas gift. So I would say like the worst Christmas gifts is like, it's like clothing that is too small for me. Never in my life have I been a small. I don't ever want a t-shirt to hug the contours of my body. I just don't. So it's more like I hate being given stuff that I like can't actually, like literally can't wear. Best gift I actually got at the holiday party.
Oh, yes.
A new friend named Drew, who was a plus one of one of my friends, brought me a framed photo of Diane Keaton, not Diane Keaton in the Family Stone, but the same portrait that Sarah Jessica Parker gives the entire family.
The young Diane Keaton doctored to look pregnant with Rachel McAdams photo.
Yeah. And I guess he said that he screen capped the image like from the film and had it printed and then put it in a frame. And it has been by my fireplace ever since. And it will be part of my holiday decor for the foreseeable future.
I feel like your answer dovetails nicely to this question that we got, which is any ideas for holiday decor that is not the traditional tree, lights, etc. So perhaps recreating a prop from one of your favorite holiday films.
I don't know. That question is hard for me because I'm like, why would you not want a tree? Like, trees are major. Like, the whole thing, like, that's magical about it, it's the bringing the outside indoors, right? So it's like, if you don't have a tree, I would want, like, a garland.
Yeah, I've been seeing all over TikTok these paper chain garlands, like the ones we used to make in elementary school.
Everyone's making those this year. It's weird how every Christmas there's like a new micro trend. So like last year it was like bows.
Right.
And that has continued, of course, but...
Here, I'll tell you what not to do is, I don't know, about 7 years ago, I bought these abstract glass trees from CB2.
Sorry, I almost spit out my Diet Coke.
And as Chelsea points out every year, they just look like glass dildos.
They do.
I gotta get rid of them.
Like, I mean, they look more like butt plugs than dildos. They look like the kind of thing that, like, emergency technician sees on an x-ray on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, I gotta get rid of them. It just don't do that. See, I feel like a few years ago, I leaned towards what I think this fuckhead is trying to do, which is like non-traditional stuff. And I'm here to tell you, it will just end up looking like a butt plug and everyone will have questions.
Yeah, I don't know if we need to like subvert Christmas so much. Maybe you could just like hone in on a different facet of Christmas than you usually do. Or like back to our conversation about Fanny and Alexander, maybe see like, what do all those fabulous Swedish people do for Christmas? They have their little painted horses. They love their gnomes. They have those like fabulous crowns of greens with the candles and shit. Like, do something fab like that.
Yeah, what did the Swedish American Girl doll do, Kristen?
She had her whole like Festival of the Lights outfit, which is what I'm trying to describe, trying and failing to describe.
I see why you would come to us for non-traditional Christmas ideas, but unfortunately, we're feeling very trad this year.
Okay, this is an easy one. Home Alone 1 or 2?
1.
Yeah, I would say 1, 2, because you can have Home Alone 1 without Home Alone 2, but you can't have Home Alone 2 without Home Alone 1.
Wait, now I'm confused. So you're saying Home Alone 2 is the superior film?
No, Home Alone 1 is the superior film because so much of Home Alone 2 was recreating things that already happened in Home Alone 1, like the entire movie, basically.
Oh, yeah. No, it is one of those sequels that's just a Xerox of the first film. Although the second film has your crush, the Pigeon Lady.
But like... The Pigeon Lady, exactly. It's like, okay, we need a new sad old person because we can't have the snow shoveling, like, old guy that's estranged from his family, like the Boo Radley from the first film.
Yeah, so instead we need to traumatize this child walking through Central Park at night alone.
Look, he learned a very important lesson about homelessness.
Unhousedness, Chelsea.
And the Christmas spirit and how Christmas is about giving and shit.
I was embarrassingly old when I learned that that old-timey noir film, the black and white film, is not a real movie, that they recreated that for Home Alone and then its sequel, Home Alone 2.
Yes, they did. But, I mean, ideally, it's like I love Home Alone 2. Like, watching them back-to-back is one of the best things you can do.
Yes, but unfortunately, Trump is in Home Alone 2, which takes it down a few notches.
Okay, we got a couple similar questions. One was, how do you feel about elasticized waistbands? And the other one was, how do you feel about the rag and bone sweat pant jeans for a gift or in general?
So I was formerly unaware of these rag and bone jean sweatpants.
Really?
Yeah, I did.
Lauren, I wear them all the time.
Do you really?
Yes, I wear them all the time.
So I went to the website. This is how they're described. Miramar, our revolutionary printing technique makes any material look like denim. These wide leg pants are cut and sewn from cotton terry cloth that's ultra soft on the inside and printed on the outside to look like your favorite jeans.
See, you didn't even know I was wearing sweatpants that whole time. I think they're great. I travel in those a lot. One thing I will say is that, like, sometimes the bottom hem like flips up a little bit, which like drives me crazy because it like ruins the illusion that it's denim. But that didn't happen until I had worn them a considerable amount. And to be fair, I never bought them. Like, they were tats, and then at some point I just like stole them.
So do you have more than one pair? Like, after wearing the initial stolen pair from Tat, you're like, ooh, I need more colorways of this.
I just have one, but I've worn them so much that I honestly just need to replace them. Like, they've been through too much.
I mean, I do take your lead on leisure wear. Like, you introduced me to the wide-legged sweatpants from Uniqlo that I wear all the time. So perhaps I should get in on this rag and bone jean sweatpant.
Yeah, I like elastic waists in general as someone that like can't commit to being the same weight for more than like a year or two. It's kind of necessary for me. And also like I have all sorts of pants with elastic waist. I have ones that have normal that are more tailored also, but like I don't think one is necessarily better than the other.
When I was pregnant, I had to exclusively wear elastic waist pants. And I think my annoyance is when there's drawstring, like when you got to tie it in a little bow and it's an elastic waist. Just give me an elastic waist that looks like it could be a normal pant.
Yeah, or like the pleats please trousers. Iconic pant with an elastic waist. Just saying.
So this has the Every Outfit approval for a gift, although I don't know who you're giving this gift to. Perhaps it won't be received as well as if we receive the rag and bone sweatpant jeans.
Okay, last call.
Hi, Lauren, Chelsea. I just finished reading the Valley of the Dolls book, and then I saw the movie. And I'm wondering, like, and of course I Googled this, but why do you guys think there was never a remake of the movie made? And if you could cast anyone for the three main girls, who would you cast? I love you guys. I love your podcast. Bye.
I've been waiting my whole life for someone to ask me this question.
Well, did you see that there was an attempt to do a Valley of the Dolls remake in 2016? Now, the only source I could find for this was IMDb and Out Magazine, but it was alleged that in 2016, 20th Century Fox was trying to put a remake together that would see Madonna, Jennifer Lawrence, and Anne Hathaway in the film, with Emmy Rossum being eyed for the role of Neely O'Hara.
Okay, that's terrible casting. That's really bad. Emmy Rossum could be Anne, or could be the role that I assume is going to Anne Hathaway in that scenario. The character is also named Anne. Madonna as Helen Lawson would be really iconic, I have to say. But all of them, they're too old for it now. Like, this is a movie about women in their 20s.
So maybe it's because I was catching up on I Love LA, but I do feel like there's an I Love LA version of this film where, hear me out.
Okay.
Iowa Debris as Neely O'Hara.
No!
I have been taken by her British pop star persona on I Love LA. I could see Odessa Azian as Jennifer North.
Okay.
Rachel Sennett as Anne Wells. And Leighton Meester as Helen Lawson.
Okay. This is the worst thing that you've ever suggested. I'm just being honest.
By the way, I do have a more contemporary cast that probably would happen in the remake. I just wanted to see your reaction to the I Love LA-ified remake of Valley of the Dolls, which clearly you don't fuck with.
I don't fuck with. Okay, this is my casting. The role of Jennifer, played by Sharon Tate in the film, will be Sydney Sweeney. This could be her greatest performance, honestly.
Are you doing a Euphoria version of this?
No. The role of Anne, played by Barbara Perkins, frankly the most boring character, will be played by Mikey Madison.
Okay.
The role of Neely O'Hara, played by Patty Duke, who is really the best part of the film, should be played by Cola Scola, really. But I think that Mia Goth could be insane in this role.
Okay.
And also Mia Goth, Sydney Sweeney, and Mikey Madison, they all look like they could be in the 60s. Like, they, you need to have 1960s face.
So I do have a different version of the cast. And actually what I thought was good, technically good version. So I had Anya Taylor-Joy as Neely O'Hara, who is someone that also has 1960s face.
Yeah, she does.
But who's your Helen Lawson in your version?
Well, I'd love to bring Joan Cusack out of retirement, honestly. Ooh. I think that would be major because it's like, at least in the film, like Susan Hayward's performance is so campy, but I do feel like it should be someone like a Sharon Stone or a Demi Moore or someone that used to be sort of like an A-list actress and is now a bit washed up. Not that Demi Moore is washed up anymore, but that is what the character is.
See, in my better version of this remake, I had Julianne Moore as Helen Lawson.
Julianne Moore would be incredible.
Because she's not washed up, but she can play washed up. Like, if you've ever seen Map to the Stars?
Oh, yeah.
The Cronenberg film?
Julianne Moore would be incredible in that role. As for why there's never been a Valley of the Doll remake, I don't know. Because I remember when I first saw the film, I would have been in middle school or something. I had just read the book and I was so obsessed with the book that I was like, this movie sucks. Like, it took me years to appreciate the camp value of Valley of the Dolls. But like, of course, you have no context for what camp value is when you're like a child. To appreciate camp, you have to have like a broader understanding of culture, I think.
Well, it's also a film that, as you know, got a sequel, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
An unofficial sequel.
A film written by Roger Ebert.
But like, yeah, it's such a great story. They fumbled the bag with the movie. They should do it again. They could make an actually good movie. And it's the same with like The Bell Jar. There's a terrible movie version of that. They should try again.
I mean, I think just with the state of Hollywood, it's more likely that it would be a limited series, which is, for most books, the way to do it. I mean, that is often the problem with movie adaptations of books, is that you have to omit so much of the story and storylines to make it fit within 2 hours, 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
I love that this is the question you chose to end our holiday mailbag episode on.
Also, directed by Sofia Coppola. Boom. Yes, because I'm so grateful that someone asked that. It's literally something I think about all the time.
Well, there you go.
And with that, we conclude our holiday hotline episode.
But we will be back next week with a Sex and the City rewatch episode. We are not going to leave you hanging during Christmas. We know that things are rough with families and such. And also, next week on our VIP channels, it's a Christmas miracle. We will be talking about the Kardashians.
It's a Christmas miracle for some and a Christmas nightmare for others.
If you've been dying to know our thoughts on the latest season of the Kardashians, Kim's masterclass,
Bianca Censori's performance art,
Kendall Jenner's latest Architectural Digest tour, Timmy and Kylie on the Marty Supreme red carpet, we'll be getting into it all. Just in time for the holidays. All right, guys, we'll be back next week. Again, happy holidays.
Ciao.
Ciao.